As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
This is Talk of the Devils, the Athletics podcast dedicated to Manchester United. And well, after a pretty awful couple of weeks off the pitch, we were hoping to have something more positive to talk about on the pitch. And we couldn't have been more wrong.
Gianpietro! It's three! How about this? Brighton and Hove Albion are 3-0 up at Old Trafford. And while they celebrate, the home fans leave in their droves.
Right, coming up, we'll pick the bones out of that terrible 3-1 defeat for United against Brighton at Old Trafford, and we'll also look ahead to the, I don't know what the right word is, but we're going to look ahead to Bayern on Wednesday. I was going to say daunting, but I don't want to kill it right at the top. We've got a full house together to talk about everything Manchester United today on Talk of the Devils. So we've got Andy Mitton, we've got Laurie Whitwell, and we've got Carl Anker. Laurie, I'll come to you first. What's the matter with Manchester United?
Obviously, we spoke about the off-field stuff, which does then impact on the on-field. You know, the fact that you've got Jadon Sancho and Antony, two right-wingers, not in the team. You know, Carl obviously wrote his detailed piece about who was going to start on right wing for Manchester United, much as he did with his Mark Cucurella piece, backgrounder. Both pieces had a short shelf life because United didn't start with a right winger at all, and that kind of feels like that was Ten Hag's solution to, you know, the disciplinary proceedings around, you know, Jadon Sancho and Antony. But it worked for a little bit, didn't it? First 15-20 minutes were quite exciting. You know, United got after Brighton and kind of caused them some trouble. You know, the press was working well, but then Brighton adjusted and, you know, they picked their way through United, and it is despondent that it wasn't really that surprising. United have spent five times as much as Brighton in assembling, you know, this squad, and the wage bill is obviously many times bigger as well. But they are just a much better run club. Yeah, we can question Erik ten Hag and we can question the players for sure, but I think ultimately that kind of sets the tone for the whole club.
Carl, three defeats in the first five games for Manchester United in the Premier League for the first time ever. It's the first time since 1989, they conceded 10 goals. Only Wolves and Burnley have conceded more. This is just some of the headline stats from the first five games on the pitch. Laurie spoke about off the pitch. We'll go into it more as we go along, but I'll ask you the same. What's the matter with this team at the moment?
Not good without the football, and they're not great at scoring when they have the football. It's brutally honest. Last season, there were two or three moments where Ten Hag made in-game adjustments, and it helped turn potential draws into wins. In these opening five games, there have been moments where the opposition manager makes an adjustment and Ten Hag just hasn't responded. So we saw this against Spurs, you know, very, very good foot staff against Spurs. Second half, Spurs play wider. So the centre-backs stand wider, the full-backs really, really stretch a play, and then United's attempts to press high up the field. They can't cover the space. This game against Brighton, it took 20 minutes. Took 20 minutes for De Zerbi to go, oh, right, they're pressing us. The front two is pressing us with, and, you know, Fernandes is going to pick up the free man. Let's just make a centre-back stand wider. Rashford, who's never been the best presser, really seems to struggle when pressing from centre-forward. So once it goes wider, he stops being a good off-the-ball presence. And then Brighton just start attacking the space on the left-hand side because Christian Eriksen is not the most defensively minded player either. So 20 minutes for United's good plan to be undone, and Ten Hag can't respond, or the way Ten Hag wants to respond is not available to him because he's got a team just absolutely decimated by injury and other situations.
Andy, Laurie said it before, it didn't feel like a surprise, and it really should have done given the fact that United hadn't been beaten in the Premier League at home for over a year. And the last time, of course, was against Brighton right at the start of Ten Hag's reign.
Well, I think it had been coming because against Forest, United came back from 2-0 down. Against Wolves, Wolves were the better side, and the two away games have been lost. And Brighton's form against Manchester United has been excellent. That's four straight wins now. They were very good at Wembley in that FA Cup semi-final game, and they're actually very good throughout. And manager, owner, as Laurie said, stadium, training ground, recruitment. Is there any club in world football better than it now? The fact that they can go to Barcelona and now get Ansu Fati, and it's seen as a good thing for him to go to Brighton because the football is so good, they're so progressive, is a massive compliment to Brighton.
And he's on the bench after they've made six changes.
Yeah, yeah. And people talked about United injuries, and that meant that United had to change the tactics because Anthony probably would have played and United wouldn't have gone with that diamond. But I don't think anyone was really stunned. We tried to be optimistic before the game, but the alarm bells have been there in every single game that United have played so far in the league. And there has been a slump in the mood among fans, seemingly in the confidence of some of the players. There's questions all over the place. Why were the best players from last season, people like Martinez and Casemiro, why have they been so mediocre so far this season? Brighton got more confident as the game went on. They were brave, they were skillful, they were technically excellent. A friend of mine, Dean Holden, who's just lost his job as a Charlton Athletic manager, he was at Old Trafford because he's a United fan. He said, I've never seen a team off the ball as good as Brighton. And you know, that's someone who knows what he's talking about. And it was almost humiliating the way that Gross sat Martinez down. So many side strands. Daniel Welbeck scored yet again. This is a Manchester lad who's a big United fan. And as you said after the game, I was just being professional. If I'm going to try and be optimistic looking forward, you know, the fixtures after the Bayern Munich game, there's a big run of games at Old Trafford. But I'm not feeling good about Manchester United at all at the moment. And you know, Brighton, the way that they put the fullbacks high and wide, their overloads were so effective. And you're thinking, why can't the manager see this? If we can all see it during the game. United had worked on this plan for a number of days. So 2 days before the game, all the players knew that this was going to be the formation. Did that get out? You know, on one level, you'd say no because...
No, I mean, I wrote a whole piece about a right wing, so...
Yeah, but you know, but there were accounts on Friday night, Carl, saying special formation, special plans. And, you know, I wonder, how did people know that? How's it getting out?
Ten Hag keeps talking about turning United into the best transitional team in the world. And transitions aren't simply... Can United score counterattacks? It's also how United defend against counterattacks. That Brighton, the first goal, all three goals Brighton score, they get from back to front with incredible speed and incredible precision. And Ten Hag's United is not as good at playing transitional football as Brighton are. And that's concerning. It's really concerning that Casemiro looks off it. And I'm loath to say someone's legs have gone, but he's making bad decisions in a way that he wasn't making last season. He played a lot over the international break with Brazil as well, so you can chalk up a little bit of mental fatigue there as well. Lisandro Martinez has not looked the same player as last season. I said before, there was no guarantee he was going to come back from injury, the same player. By all accounts, you know, he looks different. So much of what made United good last season relied upon, you know, that defensive trio of Martinez, Rafael Varane and Casemiro. Martinez is not the same player he was last season. Rafael Varane's currently injured. Casemiro is not the same player as last season. So now it's just gaps when they're trying to defend against transitions. I think Ten Hag, I think after 35 minutes, Ten Hag knew, oh God, we're getting done again because they're playing wider. But how do you solve that? Can you make Bruno Fernandes a better presser of the ball? Can you make Marcus Rashford understand how he has to curve his run even more in the middle of a game?
Martinez told me that he wasn't going to be the same player when he came back from injury. He said he was going to be an even better player, which sounds nice and you nod along, but we've not seen the evidence of that so far. That defence have now conceded, well, the team have conceded 10 goals in four games. It's pretty alarming. United did start okay, looked a threat. A couple of tight margins have affected Manchester United. The goal at Arsenal, which wasn't, from Garnacho, Hoyland's goal, which wasn't. You know, we're talking millimetres, centimetres here, and people will argue the case on that. I sense that United are not getting the breaks at the moment, but bigger than that, I'm not really convinced by what I'm seeing either.
Laurie?
They're soft to play against. I mean,
yeah, soft is the word.
I would take slight disagreement with what Carl says about Brighton's attacks. I don't even think they were that fast. The goals that they scored, you had the first one was Danny Welbeck passing out to the wing and then kind of just jogging into the area, and Casemiro and McTominay just let him, and then he's free in the box. Pascal Gross's goal comes from him switching the play over to Mitoma and then also sort of, you know, following into the box and again not being tracked.
27 passes in that move from front to back.
So they built their moves, you know, really nicely, Brighton, and they are obviously a very good team. But then United just seems so easy to play against and score goals against. And you just think, as an opposition team, you must be thinking, if we just stay in the game long enough, okay, they started brightly, they pressed and they harried us to begin with, but, you know, we made that tweak. I am really fascinated to know if Brighton did know, Andy, because, I mean, De Zerbi afterwards was, you know...
Yeah, he was explicit,
he was saying,
he?
Yeah, we didn't know and we had to adjust and, you know...
Jason Steele, I interviewed after the game, he said that United started with a different formation to what we expected and we needed to adapt in the early period. They did adapt, but yeah, that neither of those things suggest that they did know, but that doesn't mean that they didn't.
Yeah, I'm really sceptical about that.
Well, it's one thing to know, isn't it? It's another thing to be able to know exactly how to play to exploit the exact way that Manchester United are playing. Sorry, Laurie.
I do touch on what Andy says, you know, fine margins, you know, could it have been onside and you know, then they win at Arsenal? Could they have allowed that goal? I mean, I know, you know, maybe tinfoil hat time here, but I don't know.
You were on Twitter stirring the pot, weren't you, lad?
How can they disallow that goal? And I don't care that there's an image that looks like the ball's fully out, maybe. Like, the one from behind Rashford looks like it's not out, definitely. And then, you know, you need that shot over the top. I mean, Karim Mitoma, who was obviously playing for Brighton, knows all about that. You know, World Cup, everyone thought that ball was out, and apparently it was in when the angle over the top showed it, and Japan knocked Germany out. So, I don't know how they overturned that, but anyway, Brighton were the deserved winners, weren't they? That wasn't the difference at Old Trafford, but I suppose as Ten Hag said afterwards, he didn't make an issue of it. He just said, when you looks out, you know, you have to make your own good fortune. And after the game, he walked onto the pitch. I thought, oh, is he going to make this all about the referee? You know, sort of deflection tactics and kind of have a go at the referee. But no, he just shook his hands and walked off down the pitch. And Old Trafford was pretty empty by that point. You know, usually. Obviously, after the Forest game, there was a big protest. Everyone stayed behind, and yeah, there was loads of empty seats this time, way before the final whistle. And I don't know if we should touch on that. I mean, that's the first signs of kind of discontent at Old Trafford towards Ten Hag. You know, obviously when he took Hoyland off, and then the boos at the final whistle.
You're starting to hear murmurings about Ten Hag, and that happens with results. I think when you call out players, and he did with Jadon Sancho, not every other player is going to like that. They just don't, and the fans. You're starting to hear people. I think he's still got the support of most people. I certainly still support him. I think he's handled most decisions well. He's going for a bad patch. It happens. You mentioned earlier on, Ian, it's the worst start since 89. Well, Alex Ferguson was in charge then. In 89, that's when the flag went up in J-Stan saying 3 years of excuses to R. Fergie. Eric Ten Hag's had 1 year and he's not made many excuses because he's been far more successful. But Manchester United is a very, very different club now compared to them. You hope that this year things do not get bad and the corner is turned, as it was last year after a pretty bad start. But I think everyone's confidence has really been knocked that we're critiquing some of the best players. You know, Casemiro, when he started games last season, I would think United are not losing this game today. And it wasn't a one-off. It's been the whole season. In fact, you know, since maybe April, Manchester United have been more doubtful, and let's see what the new signings are like. A lot of pressure on Hoyland. Let's see how he does. I was impressed by his start to the game. I think, in fairness, he was always coming off after an hour, so the manager was on a hiding to nothing there, and some fans were booing that decision, which shows how low Anthony Martial stock has fallen among fans.
Well, I didn't read it like that. I know that was the way that the questions were asked a little bit in the press conference after the game, but it just felt to me like fans were so frustrated at what they'd seen. Hoyland actually was a real plus point for United. And I get it, you know, he's not started a game. That was the first one he'd started after his back problem. He'd not had that many minutes for Denmark during the international break. He'd had 20 minutes at Arsenal, was it? Something like that before. And they didn't want to take any risks. Ten Hag explained it afterwards, and you can totally understand that in, you know, the cold light of day when you're going through exactly the measure of that decision, we can't take a risk, we need him to be fit longer term, fine. But in that moment, I think fans were just so frustrated. There was a little bit of frustration, I think, towards Rashford just before that as well. So maybe it may have been a little bit of that packaged in. But I think we should home in a little bit more on it, Laurie, if we can. You sort of mentioned it in your pieces on The Athletic after the game, but it may have not been the first overt display of fans being unhappy with a decision that Ten Hag had made, but it was certainly the loudest. And when you sort of pair that with everything that's going on with Sancho at the moment, you know, how big a challenge do you think there is to his authority at United right now?
Whenever the results are bad, you're going to get people questioning why, and obviously the spotlight falls on the manager. He picks the team, and clearly when you take big decisions like he has, that's going to ruffle feathers. Personally, I think that he remains a hugely positive aspect of Manchester United. I think we've been in this situation before with the manager, and it's rinse and repeat. You know, I said at the start, it goes all the way to the top, and the mismanagement and the way that transfers are done, and you know, the support that he's given around the dugout, I think, you know, can still be better. So, and that's not to absolve Ten Hag, these decisions that are made on recruitment, but I think when you look at the kind of players he's bringing on compared to Brighton, and it's, you know, they're bringing on better players, more established players, and I know that's partly to do with injuries and his own decisions about sort of discipline in the squad, but it's quite startling that, really, and that's probably the biggest concern when you look at what can he do to change this. And maybe he doesn't. Maybe, you know, he persists with what he's been going with and hopes that, you know, repeated showings bring about a change just by, you know, force of habit. But there's not really loads of scope for him to alter in terms of personnel, I wouldn't say. And certainly in terms of, you know, playing style, you know, having players that do what he wants them to do. But yeah, I agree with you that it was the first show of dissent in towards Ten Hag in this era. The only other bits that I suppose you could possibly bracket in with that are the chants for Alejandro Garnacho that have happened, you know, last season, and then even on Saturday, which obviously isn't a show of defiance against Ten Hag, but it's kind of, we want this guy on, you know, come on, bring him on. And I think Garnacho was
out.
Yeah, so it is a little bit of kind of disagreement with the manager in that regard. But yeah, I mean, Garnacho certainly was enjoying having his name being sung, I think.
No, he was like shaking his head when all the fans were singing, you know, for him, and then he sort of like stripped off his jacket in this incredibly dramatic way and threw it to the ground like, come on, I'm ready, send me on. But it was 85 minutes. I mean, that, Carl, that was one glaring aspect, wasn't it? That was the change in shape. That was the twist, the 85 minutes. I mean, United were 3-0 down after, what, 50-odd, was it? Something like that?
It's concerning. You know, Ten Hag is not making the adjustments he made last season. He had really, you know, I mentioned in the Brighton defeat last season at the Amex that it was really fun being sat behind the dugout and watching basically Ten Hag and De Zerbi side-eye each other constantly and make tweaks to each other's tweaks. And he's beginning to look, he being Ten Hag, is beginning to look a little bit fed up.
Can you blame him?
A little bit. Am I allowed to say that? A little bit.
If you want to, yeah.
He's made a lot of big bets coming in for this summer, and I think the boos over Hoyland is the first big sign that there's a section of the United fan base that's looking at him differently. You know, maybe he's not the be-all and end-all. I think Ten Hag is a fantastic tactical mind. I think he's a brilliant tracksuit manager, and he's best on the training field developing players and coming up with tactical plans. I think there is so much going on at Manchester United at the moment, and there's so much dysfunction. He doesn't have time to focus on what he's really good at and has been given two or three other jobs that are a bit weird. You know, I can't put that any more intelligently. There's a bunch of United fans who are constantly talking to me, why on earth did we spend 55 million on Mason Mount where we needed a player, that, you know, another player better suited to standing next to Casemiro? Why did Manchester United spend north of 80 million on two right-sided players and neither of them are in the squad? Okay, some things you can't foresee or litigate against. But I know a lot of you, you know, I'm looking at Aston Villa right now, looking at Diaby going, you're really good. But also there's the thing of, I'm looking at players who look very, very good in similar positions and knowing they wouldn't be that good playing for Manchester United because there's just a mess, a malaise, I don't know, you know, a Manchester United-ness that affects any player that comes here apart from Bruno Fernandes, maybe?
That's what he's trying to fix, isn't he, Ten Hag, with the standards mm-hmm. idea, with the principles. So that's your sort of base. So then you've got accountability for turning up today in training and giving your absolute maximum, doing what's asked of you on the pitch in a very specific way. You know, I think you touched on the Rashford element, and he was brilliant, wasn't he, with the ball. He was United's best attacker. He, you know, he looked like he was going to do something every time he got it. But then on the flip side... Apart from pass. Well, he passed to begin with. That cross to Højlund, you know, first up was good, wasn't it? And he did obviously pass for the goal that then got ruled out, but he just maybe took too long and did the ball cross the line. Who knows?
Yeah, he got visibly frustrated as the game went on.
The one in the second half's the one, isn't it, where he should have crossed it and he shoots near post.
That's, I mean, Rashford had 9 shots in that game. That's the most he's ever had in a Premier League game.
So he obviously feels the burden to do it, you know, to try and make a difference. And I certainly know that he would like a situation where there's goals that you have at like Man City where there's a kind of a sort of standard procedure. A Brighton goal, really. I mean, Brighton, how many times did they score that goal where they get their eye line, cross it back?
Gross has done it 7 times against us, it feels like.
Well, that Danny Welbeck goal was basically the same as the Pascal Gross goal at Old Trafford previous season, just on from the other flank.
It really hurts when Danny Welbeck scores against Man United.
And then that Mank accent afterwards in Match of the Day, and it's just like, well, I mean, that was you know, so many years ago, but it kind of goes back to that. It's these decisions that happen, you know, and sliding doors, and I know they're difficult, but, and you talk about Diaby there, Carl, and that's what I think I mean in terms of having a manager that is supportive, you know, in the round, and okay, maybe you could say, well, he's the one that's pushed for Antony, you know, who's now out of the team. He's the one that's pushed for Martinez, who's, you know, had a difficult second season. Casemiro was perhaps, you know, one where it was a joint decision based on who they could get at that moment in the season. But there's not been the kind of collective energy to produce a squad that all fits together over, you know, several years, which is what you've got at Brighton. I mean, you look at all those players that they buy, they're all on an upward trajectory. They're all, you know, sort of, they've got something to prove. They all fit into a certain stylistic pattern. I mean, De Zerbi said something interesting. He did say that sometimes the characteristics of who he's putting in these positions, you know, so Tariq Lamptey comes in for Estupiñán at left back, you know, he's a right-sided player really, but different kind of characteristics, but the quality doesn't dip. It, that's what he was saying. So, and can you say the same about Man United?
Andy, this is absolutely unprecedented, isn't it, for a Manchester United manager to have to deal with all these issues? It's quite incredible, really, that the season is only 5 games old when you've considered they've gone through the Mason Greenwood situation, they're going through the Antony situation, the Jadon Sancho to deal with, there's uncertainty over the owners, there's been injuries to key players. Even the bloody story about them not having the right O's for Rasmus Højlund shirts in the Megastore, it just feels like everything is being scrutinised and not being great at the moment. And Ten Hag has to deal with all of that noise and somehow create a coherent football team amongst that. I mean, any manager in the world would find that difficult, wouldn't they?
I think he can try and block out what he can. There's always noise about Manchester United, even more so when the team are not doing well. And the big issue is the ownership. United fans deserve to know what is going on.
As you can tell from our conversation, quite a lot to unpack from the Brighton game. There's lots of great writing on The Athletic about it from Carl, from Laurie. Also, Ahmed Walid as well, who I need to point out because he's done a piece explaining exactly the tactical tweak that Brighton made, which seemed to exploit Manchester United's diamond. It's all on The Athletic now. If you're not a subscriber, there is an offer on at the moment, £1 a month or $1 a month for the first 12 months when you sign up at theathletic.com/ManUnitedPod.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Right, as we seem to need to do overtly in recent times, let's pick out the positives. Rasmus Højlund was really good, Laurie, wasn't he? Again, you know, and you talked about, you know, the atmosphere around United and how it seems to affect players and so on. At least at the minute, he seems immune to it, doesn't he? Apart from the fact that the ball went like a millimetre over the line, maybe. I know you'll argue with me, but he was great, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he had all the energy and determination that you want to see on the pitch. And that's why fans were upset when he came off. You know, as soon as his name was read out, that was when the boos started.
But it stopped when he'd got to the edge of the pitch as well. As he sort of stopped at the edge,
yeah,
the boos went...
Turned into applause
for him, and then Martial came on. If you were annoyed at Martial coming on, then presumably the boos would have continued as Martial ran onto the pitch, as has happened with previous players as well. Sorry, go on.
That's, you know, a reflection of, you know, obviously the substitution performance against Arsenal, which he made an impact on. And again, the way he started against Brighton. I mean, it was a good finish actually as well.
Yeah, the way he sort of switched feet and then poked it in, yeah.
Because if you look at the pause when they're sort of doing the VAR and, you know, is it over the line or not? And he's like basically dunks all over him and he's not in a position to score at all. But so so it's not just that he had to tap it in, he had to manufacture the shooting opportunity. Yeah, so that was obviously really promising. And clearly Ten Hag feels like he's got a player there who will adhere to what he's asking from him, and you can, you know, really get behind. He's 20, so you hope that there's a long span of time ahead for him at United. But it is, I suppose, it's a bit difficult to think of a 20-year-old just coming into the Premier League, and here we are sort of thinking he's the positive that we've got to reflect on. So yeah, hopefully it doesn't, you know, he seems like a guy that's got a pretty strong mentality. I don't think the pressure would get to him, but then again, we've seen this before at Old Trafford, and if, you know, you get into these kind of downward spirals, it can consume even the strongest of minds. But I think he is someone that United can genuinely be excited about. There was that other moment, wasn't there? I mean, even the Rashford chance, I think, came from him in midfield, turning nicely, passing it out, and then absolutely breaking a neck to try and get in the box and score. And he even flings himself into thin air, even though the ball's nowhere near him, and he's in the back of the net himself. So it's like, right, if the ball had been anywhere in that vicinity, he would have made connection to it. So yeah, I think another positive display from him.
Yeah, the signs of a bit of a partnership with Rashford, Carl, isn't there? I know we're talking about the fact that Rashford should have squared in the second half, but some of the link-ups, some of the interplay between them, the understanding, it's there, even though it's very early days.
It's coming. I think there was a chance that happened last season where we had a big chat about Rashford passing it, and I think one of us said, I'm not sure if Rashford would have made that pass, it was anyone other than Martial. It's that sort of thing. If the more they have some reps together, the more they get close together, they're gonna be really good. You know, Rashford left and Højlund up front. I think what's also really good is Højlund is. This feels ridiculous to say, but it's true. Højlund is already the best presser United have from the front. He's absolutely understood where he needs to run out of possession. He's curving his runs really well. He's blocking off stuff really well. So, yeah, just please stay fit. Oh, so much relies on him staying fit. I will also say, we're scratching for positives. United did score a goal. It was a good Hannibal. One too. From an academy player, no less.
It's a bit of a random run out for Hannibal, wasn't it, Andy? It came from nowhere, but he certainly grabbed his opportunities. No question about that.
I think probably deserved the highest mark of any Manchester United player. And of other positives, there was a lovely pirouette from Christian Eriksen, which set...
That was warmly appreciated at Old Trafford. That was when it felt quite positive. That was when United started,
that was when
really.
The first 10 minutes were going well. Yeah, absolutely.
And Højlund did get in front of Lewis Dunk a couple of times. If that connection with Marcus Rashford can be honed, then that's potentially exciting. It really looked like a number nine when he was getting in front of a very difficult player to play against. As for accentuating the positives, I actually think Erik ten Hag and some of his players do that a bit too much. You'll see a defeat and then you'll hear them in the media talking up the performances, and maybe that's a confidence thing, maybe that's a strategic thing.
The manager does that.
No, I know he does. And several of his players do that. And I'm not always convinced by that, because you know what you've seen with your own eyes. You don't need telling if something's not been up to scratch. Now, I know results will always, always, always set the mood. So even after that Wolves game, which was pretty alarming, wasn't it? But because United won, we can smile about it with a nudge and a wink and, unlucky Wolves.
Forest as well, but, to be honest.
Yeah, but when you start losing, that can really come back and bite you. And I think they do it quite a lot. I think they try and polish what's not there.
I think Ten Hag has been critical of his team in the first couple of games, but I think he realises that he can't keep hammering them since that point, particularly if he's going to be strong on someone like Jadon Sancho. I think he realises that he just can't keep being negative. So I think that's a strategic thing. Surely he knows behind the scenes that stuff isn't right.
Yeah, you get the sense that what's being said in the dressing room isn't always coming across in the interviews and the press conference, and sometimes that's maybe the right thing, I suppose, but other times you do want that candidness. I remember the run of games where it felt like Manchester United were having a disaster match after match. You know, this is going back to Ralph Rangnick, and maybe it got a bit tiresome in the end that players were apologising and sort of saying about how bad it was. But initially, at least, it felt really refreshing to hear the candidness of exactly how they were feeling and what had gone wrong and what wasn't right and what needed to change. So be interesting to see how that develops. Hopefully the results mean that we don't have to see how that develops. And speaking of that, should we preview Bayern Munich away in the Champions League? Great. Yes. Can't wait, Carl. Can you?
Can't wait. I know you said about candidness. I saw Reguilon posted, not the result we wanted.
He was all right as well, to be fair.
Thank you for your support. I'm like, you figured it out already. You've already figured out the Instagram
already,
format of...
Like, he was quite good, actually, to be fair to him, in an attacking sense.
He got forward. He very much kept attacking that left half space and gave some necessary width. Defensively, he's not a 1v1 defender, so it needs to be proper counter-pressing whenever United lose the ball. So we'll see there.
Okay, yeah.
And with Bayern Munich, I watched the 2-2 draw they had with Bayer Leverkusen on Friday, part scouting, and they weren't great.
There's a piece on The Athletic about the fact that Thomas Tuchel's not been happy, that he didn't get everything that he wanted in the transfer window. They wanted an extra defender and they wanted an extra six as well. So, but that said, the start's been strong. I mean, the second in the Bundesliga on goal difference, two by Leverkusen, who of course they drew with. They'd won all three before that. Harry Kane's scored 4 in 4, like you said, made a strong start in his new Skechers boots. I thought they were just for grandmas, but it turns out not. And Jamie Redknapp, actually.
They got great ankle support.
Okay.
You know.
Speaking from experience, Carl?
A good friend.
A friend wears Skechers.
A good friend wears the Skechers football boots and tells me they've got good ankle support, which, Harry Kane wears them, so that makes sense.
Yeah, true.
Tuchel doesn't look comfortable as Bayern Munich manager, and It seems to be already that Bayern are looking at possible Tuchel replacements, for the season ahead and whatnot, because he doesn't really seem comfortable there. The hierarchy doesn't seem too happy. Joshua Kimmich didn't seem great. He got substituted off before full time. Boom, 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 boom. This is a beatable Bayern Munich team. And if you're if Mason Mount is fit, and you can see Mason Mount playing in one of those positions in the diamond, there is an opportunity there for United to score first and really have a proper go at them. I'm not too despondent about what's going to happen on Wednesday. I'm being mildly optimistic. I'm putting two thumbs up here in like my big begging post.
But you do know that United will need to score at least twice to win, because 100% Harry Kane is scoring.
It's the away form, Laurie, isn't it, that's the concern for United as well. I mean, you can look at the issues that Bayern have got. You can try to be positive about Manchester United, but stretching back to mid-March, they played 9 matches away from home in all competitions. They've lost 7 of them. They've won 2 against Bournemouth and Nottingham Forest. That is something that needs to change straight away for them to be successful in any competition this season, surely.
Yeah, and the Bournemouth one was a tight squeeze, wasn't it? I think that was the one that kind of confirmed Champions League, but it was a bit of a knife edge for a while. The Allianz Arena is a bouncing arena when they get going. Obviously, they've got the fans behind the goal to just keep on singing, you know, swaying the whole way through. It's a really cool atmosphere to be in. So, yeah, I mean, it goes back to them being soft, really, to be able to play against, and can, well, they will, you know, that's the big question. This is a huge match for them to actually show their mettle. I know that there was moments last season where they did, and you know, there was incredible atmospheres against Barcelona, against Man City, where they sort of stood up to be counted, but there was also traumatic experiences away at City, away at Liverpool, where they kind of, did they give up, or did they just kind of, where they run out of ideas and energy. This is obviously early into the season, so you'd hope that wasn't the case. And listen here, Carl's given us some comfort there, hasn't he, with his kind of analysis of Bayern. But they also do know how to play in these competitions, Bayern, you know. So whereas it's, as you know, United returning to it, and there's, you know, it'd probably be a fresher experience for some of the players involved. But it's going to be a huge game. It'd be fascinating to see how it transpires, because it's so quick after you know, such a difficult match. Can they make the desired changes? Can Ten Hag change it? Will he change it? Yeah, really interesting to see.
I think you've got to credit Bayern Munich for only charging €30 for a ticket. It's one of the great stadiums in world football. It's one of the great cities of Europe. And rather conveniently, the Oktoberfest is on, even though we're in September. So United have played here in September before, but it was in the old stadium. That was the treble winning season. United have not won a game, not just in the Allianz Arena, but in any of the venues where we're playing in the Champions League this year. Here's one for yourselves and for listeners. Name players who've played for Manchester United and Bayern Munich. I can get 5.
Owen Hargreaves.
Played for both clubs. One is Hargreaves.
Mark Hughes.
Bastian Schweinsteiger.
Well done, Mark Hughes. 2. Schweinsteiger, 3. Well done. There's 2 more I've got.
Hans-Jörg Butt, did he play for Bayern?
No, but he played for Bayern, and he took a lot of penalties for him. He was the goalkeeper who took all
is
the penalties.
Is he the one who was at United? Am I getting mixed up? Robert Zieler, I was thinking about.
Daley Blind played for Bayern last season.
Well done. Well done. 6 month loan.
Yep.
Okay, so we're missing one more.
Did Alexis Sanchez play for Bayern at any point?
Don't think so.
I don't think so.
Made that up.
Oh.
There's one more.
Clue, Andy, maybe?
Pretty recent as well. Sabitzer.
Bloody hell. Oh. He came, that's, oh. Yeah. He was here for 6 months, yeah. Wasn't he?
Really should have got that.
And don't forget the manager.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I know
yeah.
It was Bayern Munich B, but or 2 under Pep Guardiola.
Definitely counts. Yeah, definitely. Let's just round it off then with our memories of Bayern Munich away. I wrote down what had happened for Manchester United, and I'm sort of loathe to read it out, to be honest, but we had a 2-2 draw in 1998 in the group stage, which was a brilliant game, to be fair. I think they equalised at the death as well that night. We were knocked out there in April 2001 in the quarterfinals, a 2-1 defeat. We drew 1-1 in the second group stage. Remember when we had one of them in the Champions League in November 2001? We got knocked out in the quarterfinals there in 2010 with a 2-1 defeat. We got knocked out eventually in the second leg. If you remember, United raced to a 3-0 lead, didn't they?
Oh,
and
mate.
Darren Gibson and all that fun of Rooney not being involved and then being on the start.
He was never the same after that.
In the starting 11, sorry. We also had that, remember that Patrice Evra one, Andy, as well, where United were in front and going through to the semi-finals under David Moyes for 73 seconds and they ended up losing 3-1, bizarrely, even though that was like 73.
Was it 73?
73 seconds they were ahead right. for. Right. He scored just
cracking goal.
I don't doubt you, but for years I've been telling everyone it was 38 seconds.
Well, it's probably that stat, you know.
Just stand corrected on that.
This happened the other day as well, so this is really nerdy, but anyway, sometimes people say stats about when the time of the goals were, and sometimes they say stats about when the ball was in play between the two goals. So that's why you sometimes get a discrepancy in what it was. But that is incredibly nerdy. So yeah, all in all, it's not been great there. I said they'd never fail to score in a match there, which is technically true, but Andy, that is definitely the more favourable way of terming it, I think.
Yeah, I'll tell you some of my memories. Stefan Effenberg being one of the few players to outclass Roy Keane in Manchester United's midfield. Karl Power, the imposter, getting on the pitch in Munich and no one really realising what had happened until the next day because nobody had the internet on the phones then. It was, you know, it took 12 hours for it to seep through that, you know, the guy in that odd white kit was a bit, you know, wasn't a first team player for Manchester United.
I used to get my hair cut in Affleck's Palace, this was years ago, and there was a picture of Karl Power attached to the mirror that was signed by Karl Power as well.
Brilliant.
So yeah, that is a brilliant memory. I remember the Patrice Evra one really clearly though, Laurie. I remember like thinking, wow, it's lift-off time. You know, we're going to the semi-final.
It was a beautiful goal, wasn't it?
It was a miserable season, wasn't it? I interviewed Patrice not long after that. Andy, you've probably got more experience of this than me considering you've written his autobiography. But he sort of described that goal and had all the emotion of Munich in him as well because he'd been the day before to the memorial and just all the emotion inside of him when he scored that. I think he said he cried actually when he scored that goal because he had so much built up emotion.
It was the last European away I missed. There was a small matter of my second daughter being
good
born.
Excuse.
That didn't stop me booking flights in a hotel and praying that the dates would somehow become a little bit different. And my wife just went, no. She's due like 12 hours after the game and she did arrive. As for Evra's goal, 38, 72 seconds, whatever, I once asked David Moyes about it and he was about to lose his job.
He lasted one more game.
And I said, what did you think at that moment? He just said, I just wanted that moment never to end. He just said, I looked up at the away fans and I just was under so much pressure, just like, do not end. Put within 38 or 72 seconds, it was over.
Carl, what do you remember?
I know exactly where I was when Evra scored. I'd just come out. I'd been sitting on like a beer run because I pulled the short straw. And I was like, got the alert on my phone. Oh, this is amazing. Sprinting back. And by the time I get back in, all my mates are going, mate, yeah, it's done.
Here's what Patrice said. We travelled to Munich for the second leg and visited the memorial site close to the 1958 disaster. It was a massive deal for me. I prayed at the memorial for those who died, including those great young players. I took photos. I spoke to United fans doing the same and I just felt it. Back in my hotel room, I prayed again. Normally I say thank you to God and ask for his protection for my family. This time I asked God to protect the Busby Babes and if I could score a goal for them to say thank you. I was playing this game for them. Part of the same United family as me, young boys who died, doing what I do and realising their dream. Our team travel together on planes all the time and you just take it for granted that it's going to be safe. Our form had been inconsistent going into the game, but it was 0-0 at half time. We still needed to score to go through and they'd got an away goal. David, that's Moyes, had named an attacking lineup with Rooney, Welbeck. Stop mentioning Danny Welbeck in this podcast. Shinji and Valencia up front. It worked. We created chances. And Antonio had a goal disallowed for offside. The four strikers were working well, but they needed a hand from me.
Valencia, great skill. Welbeck waits in the centre. It's in towards Danny Welbeck. It's just behind him. Here comes Evra. Evra! Oh, what a goal! That is unbelievable! Unbelievable strike from Patrice Evra. And Manchester United ahead in the game. Ahead in the tie, and an away goal to boot, and an unbelievable away goal. What a strike.
He said when he scored, it's one of the best goals I've ever scored. I knew I should have been a striker. I was overcome with emotion. I kissed the United badge. I thought about the babes, high on the top tier. The United fans bounced around singing, United, United, United. They followed us in big numbers around Europe, and now they were the ones making the noise in Munich. I ran to the side and I could see the relief in David Moyes' face.
Lovely, Andy. Well, I enjoyed that, and I hope that's whetted everyone's appetite for Bayern Munich against Manchester United all over again on Wednesday night. If you want to get in touch with the pod, as always, the email address is devilspod@theathletic.com. We'll try and work in some of your messages for the next podcast, which we'll record at the Allianz Arena after the game. Well, at least Andy and Laurie will be there, whatever happens for Manchester United. But for the moment, Andy, thank you. Carl, thank you. Laurie, thank you. And thanks for listening. We'll see you on the next one. Bye-bye.
The Athletic.